Well, thanks, everyone, for coming. This panel is called Cutting the Crap. Is cutting waste key to solving climate change? I was glad to get the little profanity in there because I'm like 5 years old and thought it was funny. I'm really excited to have this panel and this sort of interesting, diverse perspectives. I think I often write about the power sector and transport, and I think there's really we're at a cool moment where people are talking about waste in a different way, in an important way. So I'm glad to have these different perspectives. I think we'll start with some introductions. Each of the panelists will take maybe up to 5 minutes, and then I want to talk about conceptualizing the problem and then thinking about what the solutions will be. So that's sort of the frame for the discussion, with one little discussion about why this is the moment for talking about waste and climate. So with that, I'll just let the panelists introduce themselves and say whatever they might with their 5 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe we can just go down the line.
Go first? Sure. Well, thanks, Justin, for having me. My name is Alex Chulov. I direct the Zero Waste Program for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. So I deal with a lot of waste issues, and all those issues are very interesting to me. But one of the things that is most interesting to me is how we talk about greenhouse gas mitigation strategies and how we largely don't talk about our waste and consumption in those conversations. So from my perspective, those discussions are often dominated by a sector-based thinking. So we tend to think about the transportation sector and the emissions related to that and the electricity sector and those emissions. And I don't dispute that. I don't dispute those findings. And I certainly think that we need to be electrifying our transportation and moving towards renewable energy. But I do think that it sort of hides a bit of the story. It kind of hides our consumption and the effect that that has on emissions. And so I would suggest that we reorganize our emissions a little bit to look at systems. So I drew a couple crude pie charts right here that I plagiarized from the EPA. But on the left is our emissions organized by sector. So you can see transportation, electrical power, two obviously big sectors when it comes to emissions. And the one to the right of it is organized by system. And so what I mean by that is separating the provision of our goods from the use of our goods. So let's think about a car, for example. The emissions from extracting the material, the production, the manufacturing of the car, that's now separate from the emissions from driving the car. And that can be said for food as well, how we choose to grow our food, what we choose to eat, you know, versus carbon-intensive animal-based products versus plant-based products, how far we're willing to transport it and package it. All of that is sort of now considered provision and separate from the use. And we can say the same about our clothes, our electronics, our cosmetics. And so when you add up the provision of all of our stuff, that all of a sudden makes up over 40% of our total emissions. So in other words, the choices we make about our stuff, what we buy or what we don't buy, is a bigger slice of the pie than driving our cars or heating our homes. And so from my perspective, a lot of these discussions around mitigation talk about more the use phase, about electrifying cars and fuel efficiency, but not as much about buying less cars or sharing cars or building cars to last longer or making more walkable neighborhoods so we don't need cars. Same thing could be said about energy. We talk about wind power, rooftop solar, but we don't talk as much about buying smaller homes or sharing spaces. We talk about recycling, donation. We talk about the circular economy. We don't talk as much about using less or reusable or durable or modular versions of what we have. And I think it's pretty obvious that in our culture, there's, you know, a lot of our packaging and our clothes and our electronics are built to be, you know, temporary and disposable. And so I think about my grandparents sometimes, durability and frugality were virtues to them. And I think at some point we became, you know, less cool. I don't know if my generation's at fault, but I suspect in many ways that we're less cool than our grandparents. So, but yeah, you look, you know, $1,000 smartphones that we get rid of every 2 years, storage containers full of stuff that we can't fit into our homes that are also getting bigger at the same time, more people leasing cars than ever. You know, our consumption of meat and clothing is skyrocketing, you know, faster than, you know, population growth. And I think we know better. I think we know that acquiring stuff doesn't make us happy beyond a certain point. I think we know that GDP doesn't indicate necessarily well-adjusted society. And so I would submit that reexamining how we produce and consume stuff should, you know, first of all, it will continue to be a growing slice of the emissions pie. And I think, you know, potentially offset some of the gains that we might make in the future from zero-emission vehicles or from renewable energy. And so I think that needs to be as much of the discussion moving forward when it comes to emissions as anything else. So anyway.
Great.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Tony Kingsbury. I have my own consulting firm, but I'm the industry guy here in the room. I spent 25 years with Dow, 14 of it just up the road in Midland, Michigan. So that's my my Michigan. I'm not a Michigander. I'm an Oregonian. But I most of my career has been in the plastics industry, actually. I run production plants making plastics. I've worked with a variety of customers, from packaging customers to electronics to medical devices to, you know, being in Tijuana at Mattel, you know, kind of across the board. And then I got into the environmental area of plastics, recycling, life cycle, you know, all kind of all manner of environmental and sustainability issues. And kind of my final role at Dow was Global Plastics Sustainability Director. And then Dow asked me to go be a loaned executive at UC Berkeley, where I taught for 5 years and ran a multidisciplinary sustainability center on campus. So moving from Midland, Michigan to Berkeley was quite a cultural change. But at the end of my gig there, Dow said, you know, come back to Midland, Michigan, or move to Houston, Texas. And I said, yeah, I don't think so. So I've stayed out in California and have been consulting in the kind of sustainable chemistry, plastics, and packaging space. And I agree with, you know, kind of we need to look at things differently. I was thinking as I was looking at, you know, kind of our topic and our panel, the Union of Concerned Scientists did some work a while back, and they were talking about from a climate change standpoint, you know, it's about the houses we live in, our transportation, and our food. Those are the top three that we need to think about. You know, we're doing something about transportation, I think, you know, but we're, you know, trying to make more fuel-efficient cars. From a waste standpoint, I think it's going to be interesting. I think you guys are going to be writing stories about how do we deal with lithium-ion batteries in about 5 to 10 years, much as probably many of you have written stories about lead-acid batteries in the past. You know, they're not full of lithium, by the way. There's only about 5% lithium in a lithium-ion battery. There's a whole lot of other stuff in there. There's some valuable stuff in there. There's some metals in there that are very valuable, cadmium being one of them. But managing those is going to be a large issue. And managing them from a recycling standpoint is very different than a lead-acid battery where you've got 97% lead in it that you can manage pretty quickly. The rest is polypropylene. So anyway, this is, you know, we live in a world that's dealing with some big challenges, and I try to look at things from a very multidisciplinary standpoint, and that these are tough issues. And one of the things that I spend a lot of time on with my clients is alternatives. If we move from one thing to another, is it better? And I was kind of depressed. I actually had a conversation just yesterday with one of my big retail clients that was looking at changing the bags that it uses. And they, you know, and they'd asked me to kind of look into the life cycle of what the options were and stuff. And then they said, well, actually, I'm not that interested in the life cycle. What's the big picture from a climate or, you know, waste standpoint? It's what's important from an impression standpoint. So we can do the right thing, or we can do what's politically correct. And they were looking at doing what's politically correct right now, which to me as a scientist is tough. So I'll leave it at that.
Great.
Hi, my name is Annie Leonard. Nice to see you all today. I'm the executive director of Greenpeace US, which is the US branch of our global organization. We're in 50 countries, and one of the things that I love about Greenpeace is that we take no money from corporations, so we can actually say what the science demands and not have to worry about alienating any donors, which is awesome. I have worked on waste for over 30 years from a bunch of different perspectives. And I previously was at The Story of Stuff. I hope you've seen the film, The Story of Stuff. Lots of nods. Excellent. The title of this panel was, Is Reducing Waste the Key to Combating Climate Change? I would say reducing waste is a key to climate change. There is no single key, but it is absolutely essential. And there are lots of ways to try to combat climate change, but the reason that waste is the coolest is because it's so interesting. It's such an interesting entree point into so many aspects of how we run our economy and society. And in order for us to solve waste, we actually have to redesign so many things about our economy and society, and those things will make us happier and healthier anyway. So how fortuitous is this? The solution is not to, like, go back to living in yurts and wearing sandals all year round. The solution is to develop a sustainable and just and happy and healthy economy. So that's why I love waste, is it is a gateway drug to making the world much, much better. When I started working on waste, I thought the answer was to figure out what to do with a pile of waste. And the real question was, should you bury it or burn it or maybe recycle it? If you look here, I drew the materials economy, which I hope you're familiar with, that we take stuff out of the earth, we add a bunch of toxic chemicals and use energy to make it into something, we take it here and throw it away really fast, and it goes into a dump, or even worse, it goes into a landfill, and then the ash goes back into a dump. So for many years, I thought this is where the answer was. And the question was, what do we do with our waste? And the problem is, it's too late by then. You have all these opportunities up here to fix it, and you miss them all because you are at the end point. There is no rational decision to what to do with our waste. You can dump it here where it will contaminate and release greenhouse gases and all that. You can burn it where it will release all those contaminants even further and create even more toxic products of incomplete combustion. So you're actually taking regular garbage and making it into hazardous waste. Or what we've done for a long time is go dump it in a low-income community of color or send it to China. So that's the answer. And I've tracked our waste to facilities in China, Indonesia, India, Bangladesh. I can tell you all about what those look like. So then I started to realize this is not the lever point. You've got to look up here. So maybe it's here. Maybe we should convince people to not buy so much, not waste so much. Maybe that's where the lever is. The problem is that these people here are in this entire system that is designed to facilitate waste. But it's not an accident that that we focus here. And I just want to mention this really quickly because I think it's important. Because when people started really getting interested in waste, especially in the 1980s, which was a renaissance of waste, if you're interested, everyone wanted to talk about waste because waste was washing up on the beach on Long Island in rich people's neighborhoods. So all of a sudden it was an issue, and there was the Mobro garbage barge that sailed around, and landfills were filling up, and there were 400 proposed incinerators, and people knew these are an environmental health disaster, so we have to stop them. So everybody was talking about waste in the 70s and 80s and really demanding more recyclability. And there was a concerted effort by the companies that produce and push on us this single-use plastic to individualize the problem, to make us think it's our problem. You remember the famous crying Indian ad that was actually an Italian dressed up like a Native American? And so the Italian dressed up like that kayaked or canoed through a river full of garbage. And I mean, I remember being a kid and watching this so closely, and my teenager was asking, why did that have such a big impact? I was like, oh, honey, there was only four things to watch back then. Like, everybody saw this ad. And you remember the guy, the fake Indian, is kayaking through, and there's all this garbage everywhere, and a car goes by and throws out this disposable packaging, and it zooms in on that powerful tear going down his cheek, and it says, people start pollution. People can stop it. And our generation took that on. It was like, oh, I start pollution. I'm going to pick it up better. I'm going to carry my own bottle. I'm going to carry my own bag. I'm going to fix it. Because that was the message. The companies that paid for that ad are the same companies that invented the term litter bug. Because that deflected responsibility from all of this to the people there that are trapped in the system. So what I think we need to do now in our new moment that we have is look more broadly and look at the opportunities to really design waste out of the system. Make it so that you have to go out of your way to waste rather than have to go out of your way not to make waste. That is crucial for environmental reasons, health reasons, quality of life reasons, economic reasons, but especially climate, because the main ingredient for plastic is right here, is oil. Plastic is a fossil fuel-based product. To try to pretend that plastic doesn't have climate impacts, it's a fossil fuel-based product. Right now, 6% of fossil fuel globally is going towards plastic, and with the trajectory that the industry is hoping for, it's going to be 20% soon. So if you're drilling fossil fuels, bad for the climate. Burning fossil fuels at the end. I mean, incineration is burning fossil fuels that had a brief moment as a shampoo package, but it's still burning fossil fuels. Like, we have got to actually solve this problem instead of just try to sweep it under the rug by finding a new place to take it now that China won't.
Great. Yeah. So the first question I want to ask, very high level, but I think it comes across and what all of you said is, do we need to consume less, or do we need to consume smarter, or both? And sort of how do you deal with the response? You know, you talk about smaller houses, and well, what if I like the size of my house? What if I like having, you know, a new iPhone every 2 years? How do you deal with that? How do you address that? And I think, we can go down the line on this one, but
okay. At a certain point, I think the limited resources on our planet will determine that for us, which I think is why now we have an opportunity to, you know, sort of rethink things a little bit. So, you know, I think both to the answer of less and more smartly, but I think less, you know, has to be a priority, and I think consuming smartly is, you know, hopefully a way to consume less, to, you know, consume, invest in more durable products, reusable products, and, you know, stuff like that. But I think at a certain point in the not too distant future, we're, you know, not really going to have a choice. I think, you know, part of what has put us in a tricky situation is that we're just in a growth-based economic model that's very resource-intensive and requires extracting more stuff and making more stuff. And as long as we're doing that and not making the choice to consume less, then I think we're just sort of, you know, on a collision course in some ways. But I'll let some of the other panelists elaborate.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess you talked about the growth-based model, and of course, Annie, you mentioned redesigning the economy. So maybe if you could pick up there.
Right. So our economic model has many problems, you may be surprised to know. One is that it's a linear system, right, that we take, make, waste. It's a one-way system, and we live on a finite planet, and you can't run a linear system on a finite planet indefinitely. Another problem of our economic model is the obsession with measuring well-being by growth. So if we measure how well we're doing only by how fast we are taking, making, and wasting, then we're actually incentivizing an environmentally destructive set of practices. For a long time in our country, and still in many other countries, more and better goes together. Like, and when you say, do we need to consume less, we need to remember a lot of people in the U.S. and globally need to consume more.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to make room at the table, then those of us in the overconsuming parts really need to rein it in. But for a long time, more and better goes together. So economic growth was a vehicle or a tool or strategy to make life better. And it did for a long, long time and still does in many places. But it reaches the point where they start to diverge. And our commitment to continued economic growth begins to come at the cost of human well-being, at the cost of clean water and healthy children. And that should really be the end, not economic growth. So we need to look at alternative metrics like the genuine progress indicator that look at not just how fast are we ripping stuff out of the earth and moving it through that system, but how healthy are our children? Do they have lead in their blood? How healthy is our food? How satisfied are we with our lives? There's a fascinating thing called the Happy Planet Index by the New Economics Foundation in the UK, and they look at how happy countries are based on how many resources they use, because it's not really fair to compare Netherlands to Congo or something, but they look at sort of a measure of human well-being, which is happiness times life expectancy over how many resources you use. So it's basically a measure of how efficient a society is at turning natural resources into human well-being. And we are so bad on that. We are so low. I mean, ahead of us is, of course, all of Western Europe, most of Asia, most of Latin America. I mean, almost everybody is ahead of us because other countries are more effectively turning natural resources into human well-being. And if we would look at both sides of that equation, we would do much better.
Yeah, well, I think Flint is a great example of kind of talking about, you know, our society is predicated on growth. And when growth stops, i.e. Flint, when GM pulled out, it decimated Flint. It absolutely decimated. You know, the tax base was gone. The wages of many of the people living here all of a sudden disappeared, and it decimated Flint. And Detroit, you know, similar issues happened too. And it's taking them decades to kind of start to recover, you know, start to grow again. And it's growth. And so how do we somehow turn the kind of current system that we have and the measures that we have of growth into more, you know, healthy ways of growing, because the current system, you know, when it fails, as we saw in 2008, also, you know, is so destructive. You know, the boom and bust cycles, and I fear a huge bust coming. And so then after that bust, how do we choose to recover? Do we choose to recover and do the same thing, or are we going to, you know, have a real heart-to-heart with right. how we produce things? And yeah.
Tony, I want to bring up an op-ed that you wrote that's related, but sort of a more little more detailed and specific.
But
the op-ed about plastics and the role that they can play in reducing emissions and transport, et cetera.
Yeah.
Maybe just give us that sort of overview, and then we can maybe talk about that. But just complicating the
Yeah, right. So it's a piece, you can read it in Green Biz, but it's based on a research article done by some folks at City College in New York, where they looked at waste trends in the U.S. over the past, I think it dates back to EPA data, of the 60s, I think, and then kind of to today, and how typically waste grows as society grows more wealthy. We, we buy more, we consume more, and we waste more. But they looked at it from a material standpoint and how around the early 90s, the plastics broke away from that trend, in a sense. They call it decoupling in the article. I don't like that word that much. But anyway, and just that as you started replacing very energy-intensive and much heavier materials, glass, steel, and other things that we typically use, that there was a decoupling of that tracking of waste with kind of people's consumption, which kind of goes to, we have to think about the alternatives and the materials that we use, and that plastics are often demonized. I realize that. I've been in the industry a long time, and I understand that. But there's also some benefits that come from it from a resource conservation standpoint, and that's much of the reason why they've grown so popular. In North America, by the way, plastics are not made from oil. They are made from natural gas, still a hydrocarbon, I realize. You can also make the most common plastic, polyethylene, is being made in Brazil from sugarcane. You can make PLA from corn. I question how popular those need to become because you start putting pressure on land. It takes 25 square miles of sugarcane to feed the plant. And how many plots of 25 square miles do we have available to make plastics? But, it's possible you can get that carbon molecule that's in the chain to make the plastics from, lots of things. I think we should make it from waste. I think we should figure out how to recycle, recover those, keep that molecule in play.
Thank you. That's perfect. I don't know if either of you have thoughts or would want to respond, but
I definitely have thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll let him go first. Do you want to go first?
No, you can go ahead. Yeah.
You're correct. I meant fossil fuels, not just oil. That's absolutely correct. Fossil fuels, and over 99% of plastics are made from fossil fuels. So many things that I could say about that. It is true that driving around a truck full of glass bottles takes more energy than driving around a truck full of plastic bottles. That is true. I feel like that's sort of like if you had systemic cancer and you said, my fingernail doesn't have cancer. It's like that is such the driving around part is like just this little bit right here. There is still so much climate impacts of the way that we produce stuff from the drilling to the energy used here and the chemicals that we're adding, the petrochemicals we're adding, to horrifically the burning of this stuff, which is what we're going to see, because there's no way that recycling can keep up with the amount of plastic that we are creating. The amount of plastic is just exploding. There is simply no way. It was 2 million tons of plastic in 1950, about 300 million tons, I see different ranges, but about over 300 million tons in 2015. And by 2050, it's targeted to be a number that I don't even know how to say. I've never seen a number this big, 23,000 million tons. I mean, if you look at the trajectory of plastic production, it's like, boom. So when you say, should we consume better, we should produce better. It is that the leverage is at the production stage, not at the consumption. So
So yes, it's true. Driving around plastic bottles.
I didn't say anything about driving around.
Well, the transport.
I didn't say about transport.
I read that up, but it's about. Let me just finish, and then you can say. The thing is that. That also presupposes that our economic model stays the same, that we have these massive global supply chains, which we just can't have in a resource-constrained world. What if part of our solution was to decentralize production and decentralize the way that our economy works? Our economy used to be 70% production. Now it's 70% consumption. I heard Van Jones recently say, the only thing we know how to make in this country anymore is a latte. What if we brought back our economic base in this country so that we could revitalize communities like Flint, and we used inherently sustainable and safe materials that weren't fossil fuel-based and didn't have hazardous petrochemicals? I think it's possible, and that's the vision that I would have, rather than trying to figure out ways to prop up an inherently unsustainable system. But what to explain to me more about that.
No. You kept referring to glass and that's not, you know, the problem with glass from a climate change standpoint is you've got to heat it up to 2,300 degrees to form whatever you're forming, and it takes a lot of energy. Right? Far more than the transportation piece.
I read some of your stuff. I thought you were saying that the transportation of plastic is so much more energy efficient than the transportation of glass.
It's one of the pieces. But it's actually making so you know, one of the problems oftentimes with kind of life cycle analysis, people look at a kilo or a pound of plastic versus a pound of glass versus a pound of aluminum. That's absolutely the wrong way to look at it. You can do the measurement at that point, but you have to look at a functional use basis.
That's right. And you also have to look at the externalized costs.
Absolutely.
You know, the kids getting asthma by the incinerator, where does that fit in?
I'm not denying that. And we don't have incinerators in this country. Well, very few.
Sorry.
In California, how many are there in California?
Well, we have a very, very strong environmental movement in California.
How many do we have in California?
Okay.
Hundreds.
Question period will be in just a few minutes, but if you want to, sure.
This isn't just about plastics, is it? It's
waste
and climate. Yeah. Can we talk about waste?
Yeah.
If food waste was a country, it would be the third largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world.
Actually, I was going to say, in the 1980s, when waste became such a big deal, we made three big mistakes as a society. And number one, I got sidetracked with my little drawing, is we didn't set up curbside composting. And curbside composting of organic waste is maybe not as sexy as talking about plastics. It is absolutely essential. If any municipality asks me how they can resolve their waste problem, the first thing I say is set up curbside composting. Because when those organics go into a landfill, they decompose and release methane, which is an incredibly powerful greenhouse gas, and you could also be putting them back into the soil, which would alleviate the need for some fertilizer, which would also help reduce greenhouse gases. So absolutely, food waste is the number one thing that I would tell a city to do. But then the other two problems that we did is we individualized the problem of plastic, and the second thing we did is we set up collection systems for plastic, but we didn't, and other kinds of materials, but we didn't redesign the packaging to make the plastics recyclable, like having it be one resin and stuff like that. And we didn't invest in the infrastructure to actually recycle it. So many people think recycling is putting something in a blue box. That's not recycling. That's putting something in a blue box.
Collection.
And because we didn't force a redesigning of the packaging and we didn't invest in recycling infrastructure, so those were our problems. We didn't compost. We individualized the problem, and we failed to actually set up true recycling systems and ensure that the materials were recyclable. So you're absolutely right about food waste. That's the number one thing.
Want to make sure Alex has a chance to.
Yeah, sure. No,
respond.
I mean, I agree with a lot of the thoughts. I mean, what I've seen from in a residential waste stream, organics are half of what we get rid of. I mean, food waste, it's yard waste, contaminated paper. So I absolutely agree, especially about the curbside composting, and that's something that we're certainly working on. And I think also to, you know, the sort of the life cycle of plastics, I think I remain skeptical a little bit about even the ability to recycle a lot of our plastics. A lot of plastics, especially resins 3 through 7, are, from what I understand, extremely hard to recycle, if not impossible to recycle. And since China stopped accepting a lot of our plastics, there's no market to buy it. And so, you know, the investment that would be needed and the energy to, you know, in some cases chemically recycle this material would be, you know, would also be really intensive. And I think we're a lot further away, you know, sometimes than people like to suggest in terms of our ability to even recycle most of our plastics. So not to get too plastic-centric. But
But I think regardless of it's plastics or paper or aluminum or anything like that, with the situation with China, but it's also driven into Malaysia and other countries that have stopped accepting recyclables, we should be investing in recycling in this country right now. Like you said, at a local level, why are we shipping this stuff off? Now is the time to invest in the infrastructure here, to manage it here. Shame on us.
So I want to ask about the idea of a circular economy, which seems to be something that has gotten a lot of traction from various different interest groups that perhaps is a bridge between two different sides, but also there's some complication and nuance to it. Maybe we'll start with Alex just because we talked.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly support the idea of a circular economy, but I think there kind of needs to be two separate discussions, because I think there's a lot of material and stuff that we use that can be reduced, and I think that has to be a priority. You know, there are some things that are just permanently part of our society, durable things, infrastructural things, and if we can figure out a way to reuse those materials, you know, as long and infinitely as possible, I think that's a worthy goal. But I think there's also a lot of stuff, you know, single-use disposable parts of our society that we have an opportunity to reduce, and I don't think we should encourage those things to join the circular economy, because then we're sort of just encouraging this consumption culture that we have right now that's really resource intensive. Is the solution really to just every time you throw away a plastic bag to try and figure out a way to recycle it, which we can't really even hardly do right now, and then it comes right back, you know, and we just repeat that hundreds of times? Is that, you know, so there are aspects of the circular economy in that sense, especially with, you know, disposable things, that I'm much more skeptical of. With more durable infrastructural things, I think it makes sense.
Right.
So that's general thoughts.
Right.
Circular economy, absolutely. Great idea. Let's keep working on that. But let's not be stupid about it, too. And what I mean by that is, I mean, if you live in North Dakota and you're having to ship your stuff 1,000 miles by rail or by truck to get to the nearest actual recycling facility, not collection facility, place where it's actually recycled, are you consuming more fuel by doing that than you consume, than, you know, you save by actually recycling it? We need to ask those kind of questions. And so, you know, in an urban environment, absolutely, we need to figure out how to collect more, how to recycle more, how to design our, you know, our lives so that A, they're more durable, as we've talked about, and those things that aren't durable, you know, so that we can get them back into reuse in some way. You know, I'm a big believer in, you know, kind of keeping that molecule in play, whatever molecule it is, whether it's a plastic or a paper or an aluminum or an iron molecule. Keep it in play.
Is there one of the things that's come up is the difficulty, you know, just, I mean, even having the infrastructure to recycle? Is that something that you see in the medium term getting to a place where industry actually is able to recycle a significant share of what we consume?
Industry, it kind of starts with people. So Starbucks. Starbucks is under a lot of pressure to make their cups recoverable. They have a takeaway model right now. I don't see that changing very quickly with their 16,000 stores. So how do you kind of make this more recoverable? Actually, I'm not quite sure why they're so worried. This is a poly-coated paper cup. So it holds coffee because there's a thin layer of low-density polyethylene on the inside. You could put a thin layer of PLA and make it compostable, or you could put a thin layer of some other stuff. It can be recycled. The problem is that it can't be recycled at every one of the 16,000 locations that they have. And we tend to criticize if they only do it halfway. And so they're trying to figure out a worldwide solution, which is always tough because recycling is local. But anyway.
Okay, so I guess then, I mean, I'll open this to anyone who wants to answer it, but if, well, actually, no, I should follow up with you and say, so it's a, why is it not industry's role to, I mean, Starbucks could say, you know, you bring in a reusable cup. I mean, yeah. Why is that your reaction? Which, you know, obviously plays into Annie's sort of point about the people.
That's great. If Starbucks wants to change its model to reusable cups, that's fine. You know, let's ask them why they don't do that. Well, I can tell you the answer, though, and all of us in this room can tell you the answer to it, is they would lose business. And they don't want to lose business because they're in the business of selling coffee. They're not in the business of giving you a cup. And so, you know, it's about business models. And so until we can figure out how to change these business models, then we're stuck with what's the business model for end of life, which goes back to Annie's, you know, kind of we have this linear thing. And the paper industry and the plastics industry play a role, but not the only role, right? Because the plastics industry and the paper industry provide the materials, but somebody else designs it and sells it, right? And so you've got to get the chain, you've got to get the value chain engaged in these things. And we don't do that very well right now.
Right. So I'm curious in a concrete sense for really for any of you, but maybe, well, we can start with Alex, but the who is it that should be responsible? I mean, it's easy to say that industry is not the only actor, people are not the only actor, but somebody at some point has to do something that's concrete and tangible, and where should that come from, and what should that look like?
Well, I think industry could definitely share a greater part of the responsibility, for one thing, because I think right now when you look at recycling systems and compost systems, a lot of that stuff falls on the taxpayer in terms of the, you know, you having to taxes paying the municipality for a lot of these facilities. I live in Denver. We just got a facility recently that can actually recycle these plastic lined paper cups, but that's kind of a minority. I mean, you either have to separate the plastic from the paper or you have to figure out some elaborate technological way to, you know, sort of use both of those materials together. At least that's what I understand to be true. You know, so and that's something that I, as a taxpayer in Denver, you know, had to pay for, and the industry didn't really, you know, share in that. I mean, there are some companies that are, you know, funding some pilot projects throughout the country, but I think there could be a lot more of that. I think we could change the system so that industries and companies pay into the recovery of their products. Germany's a great example. They have this Green Dot program.
Yep.
You know, so I think there's a lot of ways where we should be encouraging one way or another for industry to hold a greater part of the responsibility. Because another Starbucks story, so the when they got rid of straws and they replaced them with those lids, and you can confirm this, I believe they're polypropylene lids, and that same week, Waste Management, the largest waste collector in the country, said that they were going to stop taking polypropylene plastic for recycling because the market's fallen apart, you know? And so then again, you know, the burden is not on Starbucks, it's on everyone else to figure out what to do. And I think there could be better sharing of responsibility.
So, but to press you, who's going to step in and do that? Somebody has to. That's a great vision, but how's it going to happen?
Well, one of the big problems in this country from a waste standpoint is that waste is managed at a local level. And there's, I mean, even in California that has some great policies, waste is still managed at a local level. And so I just moved from the Bay Area up to the foothills of the Sierra, and the city that I live in now, you know, doesn't recycle the same things that the city that I lived in the Bay Area. You know, and I'm you know, kind of 100 miles away. And so it's kind of indicative of how we don't have kind of standardized policies at all for managing waste. And all these contracts are done at a local level, and they're all done differently, and it's all based on what's the local MRF, a material recovery facility. That's where the kind of second step in the recycling process, what they can handle. And those MRFs, there's a whole story there, are a disaster these days. Most of them were built 10 or 20 years ago, and they were built to handle a lot of paper. And guess what's happened? There's not nearly as much paper. And so, anyway, but it's we've got, you know, Germany, as Germany can kind of do this and kind of dictate it, we as, you know, we can't even do it in California, let alone at a national level. You know, we're not getting
right.
national policies. So it's I don't know what the answer is.
Right, okay,
yeah,
right.
It's tough.
Right. Annie?
I think that we need to do it on multiple different levels. Is that people, when we do buy, should buy the least toxic, least wasteful product available. But the real leverage is not learning how to navigate a menu, but deciding what's on the menu. And that's where we need legislation. It's true we need to standardize collection, but more importantly, we need to standardize production. Mm-hmm. That materials, we should be using materials that are compatible with recycling systems, that are single resin so that they're easy to recycle, that are one material, that are designed for returning to the earth or returning through recycling. It's really the production is where the biggest leverage is. There's also a couple of other factors, though, that are very important when we're saying why is it not recycling? Why are people not recycling? One is that the economics don't pan out. That the way that the economy is now, because of the extreme externalized costs, it's cheaper to go drill up new stuff or extract new stuff and make something new. And so, you know, Starbucks is not going to recyclable materials, not because they'll lose customers, because they'll lose money. And especially in this growth-based economy, virgin materials are cheaper than recycled. So until we can get rid of some of those subsidies, it's never going to make sense. The biggest subsidy, of course, is with the cheap fossil fuels. I was recently meeting with somebody from a very, very large fast-moving consumer good product, a company whose stuff you have on your shelves in your bathroom and kitchen and stuff. And I said, so what's the latest stuff you're working on in terms of alternative materials? And oh my God, they had so many incredible alternative materials instead of single-use fossil fuel-based plastic. They had, you know, stuff that turns into fish food when it gets wet, or stuff that's made out of mushrooms, or like all this amazing stuff. And I said, so what's the obstacle? And they said, cheap fossil fuels. They said, none of this stuff is going to ever move forward. The problem is not technical. It is economic and political. So I said, okay, so what would a group like Greenpeace do? What could we do to help create the conditions for these alternatives to move forward? He said, go fight fossil fuel extraction. He said, keep it in the ground. He said, fight every new permit, every new pipeline, keep it in the ground. Because what's happening is that as fossil fuels extraction is expanding, they are looking to single-use plastics as the sink about where to put that stuff. So that will drive it. And as single-use plastics is expanding, that serves as a justification for continued fossil fuel extraction. So until we can stop new investments in fossil fuel infrastructure and get rid of the subsidies and externalized costs that skew the market, you're appealing to huge corporations' sense of concern for the planet when they have to answer to their shareholders. This is not an we're not going to win this argument on ideology or values. We're going to win it by changing the economics.
Great. Yeah. Well, questions. We're open for questions now. I guess we'll start here.
Hi, I'm Judith Ink. I used to be at EPA. I now teach a class on plastic pollution at Bennington College in Vermont. And when I was at EPA, we had the classic waste hierarchy that you're all very familiar with. It's been repeated over and over. Reduce, recycle.
Reduce, recycle.
Reuse. Yeah. And then the bottom is burn and bury. In reality, the hierarchy is flipped upside down. If you look at the money that goes into mm-hmm. each of those options, the top three, including on food waste, gets very little economic investment. And I think that economic reality is linked to when companies make consumer products or packaging, their goal is to get out a product as cheaply as they can, sell as much as they can. And nowhere is there a moment, I think, where the company stops and thinks, what happens to our product at the end of life? Because they don't have any economic responsibility for that. We buy it, our local taxpayers pay to either essentially bury, burn, a little recycle. So, you know, there are different ways of approaching this. 10 states have bottle bills. Very quaint. The curves worked a lot on bottle bills. Bottle bills work. They reduce litter, and then the companies that produce the product have skin in the game to make sure that the material is returned. I think the weakness with bottle bills, though, is it doesn't get a reduction. It just gets it recycling. So, Tony, I want to ask you, when companies are making decisions on how to design products, how does the end-of-life issue get worked in, if at all? Because I think that's kind of the crux of where the problem is, and that's why we're seeing literally hundreds of communities across the country passing local ordinances, whether it's with bags or straws or bottles, because I think the public is kind of the jig is up. I mean, everybody's read National Geographic. The public is looking for solutions, and that's why we're seeing so many local ordinances. So this is a genuine question. Does, you know,
Do consumer product companies and retailers care about this? Absolutely.
What do they do?
So the challenge is the battle within the companies themselves of the product designers versus the marketers. And too often the marketers are winning and the product designers are losing. So they're very aware of the potential to design for recyclability and recovery, a classic story that's well documented is when Walmart wanted to take liquid laundry detergent and pull the water out, essentially, and they went to the detergent manufacturer and said, "We'd like you to make a four times or whatever it was, you know, concentrate," and they said, "No, we don't want to do that because our bottle shrinks. You know, it's the same amount, and so our shelf space shrinks, and it's all about eyeballs on the shelf, right? You know." And so what Walmart had to do was go and say, okay, I'll give you end cap, give you the eyeballs if you'll do this. And so the first company did that. Their sales skyrocketed, and then everybody else followed. And so now you kind of across the board have these concentrated liquid laundry detergents. So Walmart had to force the marketers to kind of come along with what the designers knew they could do all along.
Mostly the designers with an eye toward reduction and recycling lose.
Unfortunately, yes. So how do we, that takes consumers to kind of say, we want change.
Back there.
I have two questions. Sorry, I don't have the technical expertise. So my number one pet peeve is not one single gas station I go to ever recycles. And they have an incredible, I clean out my car.
Yeah. I think the same thing. Yeah.
That type of thing, like maybe they have to go into your plastic bags that could be legislated.
Yep.
Why don't they do that? Or could a city require a gas station to, the collection company to pick up from the gas station and the local on their route?
Yep.
And then the second question is, I was at a thing in L.A. and this is Jalen Smith, Will Smith's kid.
Yep. I don't know anything about that.
Or
I haven't seen that. Although when I was at San Diego yesterday, there was a box of water, right? And they said this box, is kind of better than plastics or whatever.
Yeah. So what do you know about that? These new materials that maybe aren't so good because you can't recycle them at all versus that bad plastic bottle that you actually can't recycle.
Okay. Sense? Yeah. I mean, I really struggle with if we say at this moment in time, here's the materials that we have, and anything new isn't going to be recyclable initially, right? Technically, it can be recycled, but it's not going to be recycled until there's a lot of it. Does that make sense? Right? You need scale to have recycling. And so if we say we're only going to use PET, number one, right? We've got scale on that. Then you stifle innovation. So the next innovation, the guy that comes along that figures out how to make a package that, takes CO2 out of the air, which would be good, and, turn it, I don't know, right? But it's not PET. This is bad. So I struggle with kind of saying, here's how you have to do it. I'm much more an advocate when we have legislation of saying, here's what we're trying to achieve. Let folks get creative on how they get there. That makes sense? I mean, California has this classic law where they were trying to improve the recycling of plastic films. And so they said all trash bags have to have recycled content in them, 10% recycled content in them. Right now in California, if you buy a trash bag, it's going to be about 30% thicker than if you bought a trash bag here in Michigan. So they can incorporate that recycled content that by definition in a trash bag is going to end up in a landfill. This makes no sense to me, right? Just say, we need to recycle, more plastic film, and set some goals around that and let industry get creative on how to get there, and they will. But instead, they dictated something that kind of at the time sounded like it made a good idea, but, you know, at the end of the day, it was stupid. Sorry.
All right. Okay, sure.
Good.
So we can actually come up with some of these solutions and fully implement them.
Good, good. But there's not one solution you have to realize,
no,
right? There's
course.
No silver bullet here.
No. Yeah, in fact, yeah. Yes.
I was wondering if there's some good research out there on the impacts of plastic recycling or metal recycling facilities on the local communities that are around and if there are different techniques that can lessen the air pollution from these types of facilities.
No. Good question.
There is some, I don't know about the metal recycling just because I haven't looked at it, but I'm sure that there's lots of information about that as well. On the plastics recycling, there is some, and if you give me your card, I can send you some of it. I've visited a number of plastics recycling facilities all over Asia, and what I saw were people with no worker protection bringing in this plastic, and it tends to be the poorly sorted stuff that gets sent over there. It's true what he said, that scale is one thing you need for recycling, but the other thing you need is a clean stream of just one material. And so the facilities here who have really clean stuff, that tends to find a U.S. market. It's the stuff that's all mixed that gets sent over there, so it's all different plastic resins. You know, they have the little triangle on it and the different numbers there. You can't recycle them all together, so they have to be separated. And what I saw was workers with no protective gear, no ventilation. These facilities are hot and stinky, and there's so much exposure. The stuff that's not being reprocessed and melted, just thrown out into rivers or burned. I mean, it is absolutely an environmental health gross situation, and it's not what people in this country think of when they put their blue bin they put the bottle in the blue bin and feel so good about it. So that's, again, one of the problems with the closed-loop economy, which I agree with the concept, but we have to think about what is it we are circulating. If we're circulating plastic that has bisphenol A or PVC, if we're circulating that, you know, recycling a hazard perpetuates a hazard. So it's really important to look at the quality of the materials we use, not just the quantity. But give me your card, and I'll get you some of those.
But yeah, stuff. I mean, the facilities in the U.S. that take milk jugs and recycle them, and PET and recycle them back into bottles or into fibers, they're the ones I've been to are pretty clean. It is, yeah.
Much better than overseas.
Much better than what you see in Asia.
But remember, it's less than 10% of plastic we're recycling. So the conversation's really moving to how to recycle more. I just want to remind people, we are not going to recycle. Less than 10% of plastics are recycled in this country, even with decades and decades of public education. And I see our conversation kind of moving to how to get gas stations recycled, how to get more recyclable. Remember, we have to look at the whole system, because recycling is just looking at the end. And recycling is technically and economically and physically impossible for it to solve this problem. The real lever points are up here. So even though recycling seems easy and we're bombarded with messages that it's your fault and if you recycle, it will be better, it's too late by then. We're not going to recycle our way out of this mess.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Some places have their
diesel product, and there's one town in Belgium that had too much waste, and the EU controls that pretty tightly. So they actually started giving their residents chickens to work over that food waste, and it's been a very successful program. But, you know, how does this, I mean, I'd love to have this in our county. Food waste is, it's just such a huge sink on energy, and I don't know what to do about it.
So the Institute for Local Self-Reliance has awesome case studies. They just have a new report about 10 municipal composting programs case studies to look at very different places how to do it. I live in California, in San Francisco and Berkeley. We all have curbside composting. And at this point, like to put a banana peel in the garbage would seem so uncivilized. We would never do that. That would be disgusting. It is so simple. What our community did is first it did, before we had curbside, we had backyard composting, and the city subsidized really fancy Smith & Hawken backyard composters for us. And so there were $100 composters. We could buy them for $25. They lost $40 per bin, but they said it was worth it because of the avoided disposal cost. Because if people – you have to think about the avoided disposal cost, too, when you're thinking about, well, it costs this much money to do this. But how much money are you saving by not landfilling it? So they sold hundreds of thousands of backyard composting bins, and that's the best thing is backyard composting. And there's ways to do it in the winter and where there are bears and raccoons. There's so many different models. The next way to do it is curbside. And the nice thing about that is that you can take yard waste, tree branches, everything. Yeah. So we have curbside composting all throughout San Francisco and Berkeley, residential businesses, restaurants, everything. And you cannot get to zero waste if you do not have composting. It is clean. It is easy. It is civilized. It is elegant. It's like you just become so addicted to it because then your garbage doesn't stink. And then you don't have to have plastic garbage bags because you don't have any liquid leaking out of your stuff. So you can use old paper bags or no bag because you don't have anything yucky in there. So I cannot recommend composting enough. It sounds a little corny to be like, I'm from Berkeley and my number one recommendation is you compost. But it's true. It is true. It is really. It's happening all over the country, and it's a brilliant, easy, simple, incredibly economically effective strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'm fine, I guess. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Jessica Meejane. I'm from the University of Vermont. So we've talked about both the pressure that's put on consumers and then the need for systemic change, getting rid of subsidies, that sort of thing. But I'm sort of wondering, are there any in-between leverage points? Something that I think is easily observed is that products that are sustainable are often more expensive. It's more expensive to buy compostable plates. It's more expensive to buy organic. And just thinking from an equity perspective, that certain people might not be able to spend $8 for, like, the seventh generation dish detergent. Are there any other, like, possibilities of change between systemic policy and consumer behavior?
I have some thoughts, but I feel like I've talked a lot.
I think there are a lot. Well, Judith talked about extended producer responsibility and all those kind of models. I think that shifts incentives and kind of shifts who's responsible and you know, changes the economic scenario a little bit. So bottle bills are an example. But there's a lot of examples with hard-to-dispose of products. In some states, they do it with mattresses, which are, like, really hard to take apart. And when you think about it, everyone has a mattress. Like, there's a lot of those. Batteries, paint, stuff like that. And carpet. I think that's carpet. So there's that model is, I think, something that can definitely be pushed and expanded in different ways. One of the things we're working on, too, at PERG is right to repair. And so that's something that where we're focused on extending the life of some of the stuff we have. So it's especially true with consumer electronics, smartphones, but it's also true with farm equipment. A lot of companies actually will not allow you to repair that equipment or it'll void the warranty. And we think that's kind of ridiculous. You know, they'll weld the battery to the phone. You know, and a lot of times people throw away perfectly good and pretty valuable and hard to recycle electronic items or farm equipment where, in fact, all you needed to do was replace the battery or something like that. So I think there's a lot of leverage points in between, but those are a couple from my policy perspective that I can think of.
I want to chime in that often when we talk about waste, we think about what can we do as a consumer. And I think that that's not the most powerful place. It's what we can do as a citizen that matters more. Because if we are limiting to ourselves what we can do as a consumer, the only choice that we have available to us are choosing among things on the shelf at the supermarket. And the real choice, the real power that we have to make change is banding together as citizens and saying, how can we change the rules about what's allowed on those shelves? How can we change the corporate practices where people are deciding what's allowed on those shelves? We are just never, ever, ever going to solve these problems through better shopping alone. So I really think it's try to avoid the what can I do as a consumer, because it's really what we can do as a citizen. I sort of feel like we have two different muscles, right? We have a consumer muscle and a citizen muscle, and our consumer muscle is validated and nurtured and spoken to, and we're asked to use that muscle many, many, many times a day. So it's so overdeveloped. And then when we have huge problems like babies are being born pre-polluted with 165 industrial chemicals already in their blood, or the climate is about to go over the range in which human beings can continue to live, we're like, what can I buy different? But the real answer is get our atrophied citizen muscle and engage as citizens and work together collectively to force change, whether it's directly forcing a company to change or whether it's working for laws to change. And we can also tell the companies, don't interfere with our laws. Through ALEC, a number of these companies are actually pushing rules that would limit citizens' ability to get together and ban hazardous products. And so this is not just a waste and materials challenge and climate challenge. This is a challenge of our democracy. We need to get big money, corporate money, out of our politics, get these companies to stop funding ALEC that are thwarting our ability to make environmentally protective laws, to get big money out and then get people in, because that's how we're going to fix this, not by better shopping.
Other, in the back.
I just wanted to raise a question on John Jackson from Canada, worked on Great Lakes issues both sides of the border, and certainly what was said earlier about the toxins coming from recycling plants has been a major problem in terms of some of the recycling facilities. For example, a lot of paper mills have been turned into recycling facilities instead of trees for paper, making paper.
Yep.
And it isn't just paper, it's different trees. A lot of types of papers, like for had PCBs and so on in them. There are other things now, especially the coatings that are put on to make it that the grease doesn't go through your paper at McDonald's or wherever. And a lot of that stuff then is a discharge, and Green Bay is one example where you had major contamination. But the other toxic issue I wanted to raise that I'm just starting to deal with is, so we ban things like flame retardants, and it's great. But it doesn't solve the problem, because the industry tells us, well, we're going to escalate recycling of certain materials. And even though those materials, we no longer deliberately put those particular banned kind of contaminant into them for flame retardants, we don't put it in now as wanting to stop flame retardant. Because of the recycling process, it goes into the new products.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And we just are continuing those things that were horrifyingly banned, and EPA banned, and Canada banned, and then they're going to come out. The recycling doesn't keep them in the system. It isn't just at the recycling plant, mm-hmm. but in use, and however it's going to come out. So clearly, we have to get much smarter at not letting certain things be used in the first place.
Right.
Because we're not going to be able to really solve the problem until we get tough at the very beginning stage, the design stage, as most of you have been saying, as all of you have been saying, actually, to really solve it. And recycling doesn't solve that at all. It just continues the cycle. And so the circular economy idea makes it feel like it's somehow a closed system that doesn't let contaminants get released. Even if you're not having to go back and buy and get new materials. But there are things being released at each stage in there,
right.
Which gets us back to the issue of the toxins that are in the products. And it may be very small quantities, but the science of the Great Lakes Basin have been telling us that very small quantities have dramatic impacts on wildlife and on people. And
an interesting point. I don't know if any of you want to respond to it, but I feel like it does speaks to things that have been said to some degree. So, other questions? Yes.
So I'm a student at the University of Michigan, and I focus a lot on the nutrient. And I understand that when the Great Lakes became extremely polluted and the bottle bill was passed in Michigan, the state government sent out a pamphlet to citizens of Michigan explaining the bottle bill, explaining what they can do to change it, disseminating information, the kind of information that we're talking about here. So more or less, I think most people in this room understand the perils of the environment and how bad the issue is with recycling, but a lot of people don't, and a lot of people don't know how to recycle and don't know where to recycle and don't know if they can. For example, my hometown, the closest place to recycle styrofoam is an hour and a half away, and I talked to my school about trying to get someone in to help that, but no one's interested. No one is interested in this information that we all know so strongly. So I think that, yes, it's important to intervene at the design stage, but also we need to make recycling easier, and people need to know about it too. So I think that this information somehow, not just disseminated through the state, but if it was disseminated nationally, maybe that would also incentivize people to switch from a local model of waste collection to more of a national standard.
Another interesting point as well. I don't know if anyone wants to respond to that, but
I think any place – well, first of all, we are never going to convince everybody to do exactly what we want. And so what I say is let us set up a system so that doing the right thing is the easiest thing. You know, as Paul Hawkins says, make doing the right thing as easy as falling off a log. What if every single material that we had was non-toxic, compostable, or recyclable, then you wouldn't have to go nag and educate and try to convince people to go out of their way to do it right. I just think that's a much more efficacious and also more fun, because it's such a drag to go around nagging people all the time. Like, let's just, you know, I live in Berkeley, which is probably the most environmentally aware place there is in the country, right? And still people took plastic bags because sometimes you leave your bag in the car or whatever. Sometimes you forget. I sometimes took a bag. And then we banned, after years and years and years of educating to not take bags, we banned plastic bags. Overnight, nobody took bags. It became so, you could pay for a paper bag, but it became so stigmatized now that people, when they're buying their stuff, if they don't have a bag, they'll take their shirt and hold all their stuff like this, because like losers take bags. Like overnight, we stigmatized it. And so I'm into what we call choice editing, is change the structure within which people are making decisions so the onus is not on individuals. And any place where it is more expensive, this gets back to your equity issues of composting stuff costs, compostable plates cost more than disposable plates. Any place that is more expensive, more difficult, that you have to go out of your way and drive an hour and a half to do, any place, time that the onus is on us to have to do the right thing, that is a structural flaw, and that's what we need to change. Make the people who want to trash the planet go out of their way and drive half an hour instead of us.
Well, like you were saying in the beginning, the commercial about putting a burden on us, like mm-hmm. that really incentivized the beginning of recycling. And like, I was a kid when my elementary school teacher started cutting paper in thirds to give us out homework assignments. And mm-hmm. to deal with my report card, I get back now on a little slip of paper instead of on a manila folder, right? So I think that was like that's the first step in reducing paper. And you said that a lot of the recycling factories were built to handle paper. Mm-hmm. And now they're, since we already accomplished, not accomplished, but well, since we've already worked so much towards reducing that, now that it's about plastic, we also need to educate people on how to deal with that.
Well, many of you are suffering because of that, because it was newspapers and magazines were the bulk of that. It wasn't kind of home paper, you know.
I just think also convincing consumers that they can make a change is an important part, because yeah. right now, especially as a college student,
I would love you guys to look at this article I wrote called Moving from Individual Change to Societal Change in World Watch State of the World report, because it talks about the dangers of focusing on convincing consumers to change. There's a thing called the behavior impact gap, where we think that if we live totally eco, which I'm totally for, like I don't use disposable plastic, I have a solar panels, there's no Teflon or Scotchgard in my house, I buy my furniture used so it's already off-gassed elsewhere, I compost, I recycle, I'm like, you know, as eco as you can get. It doesn't matter. It matters for my own integrity, and it matters for bringing my values and my actions into alignment so that from that place of greater integrity, I can go out and actually cause structural change. But we have this thing called the behavior impact gap, where people overestimate the impact of their trying to live ecologically and exhaust themselves and also feel like, oh, civic duty done. I recycled. Check. I'm done. And it's just, I wish to God that strategy would work. It's just literally not going to work.
I just need to
we have to.
That needs to be done. Well, I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Well, I don't want to cut you off, but we are running out of time.
We can talk afterwards.
And so. I just wanted to give everyone an opportunity to say one last remark or thought if they have it. So start.
Yeah, I mean, well, I agree with what Annie just said about needing to change the system and not depend. I think it's too much of a burden to put on individual consumers. And I think there's a lot of things in between. You talked about driving an hour and a half to, you know, recycle styrofoam. Like, do we need styrofoam, you know, in the first place? You know, we can start examining things from more of a systemic perspective. And I also agree with what Annie was saying about, you know, flexing our citizen muscle. I mean, a lot of what we do as an organization is trying to activate that part. A lot of it is outreach and education. A lot of it is also just trying to you know, bring people together and show the elected officials that, you know, these are things that people do collectively care about, but it's hard to see that when everyone's sort of acting individually. So, anyway.
Closing thoughts from either of you?
I just coming from the corporate background, companies like Dow that I used to work at make materials to meet demand and change demand, and the companies will make different things. So I'm all for that. You know, drive innovation, and companies will meet that demand. So don't be afraid to talk to companies, too. You know, as environmental journalists, you know, get companies' perspective on things. It's an important part of the story.
Great.
I think that companies make stuff to meet consumer demand is another myth, like we can recycle our way out of this. I am a mother. I don't know any mother who demanded neurotoxins in my children's pajamas. I don't know any human being who demanded endocrine-disrupting chemicals in my cups. I mean, don't buy that, you guys. We are not the decision makers here. But the real thing I was going to say is be aware of incinerators. We are in this moment right now that plastic is piling up at these recycling facilities all over this country because China won't take it anymore. We used to export most of our plastic to China. It is piling up, and cities are freaking out about what to do with plastics. Plastic, more than 99% of plastics are fossil fuels. What I'm terrified about is that this is going to open up a new generation of incinerators, and they won't call it that because that's unpopular. So please watch for pyrolysis, gasification, waste to energy, refuse-derived fuels. Watch for these things vigilantly because these companies are going to come and try to build these things in your communities to burn that stuff because they're freaking out. They got to do something with it because it's this end of the pipe. And if you do that, those things are waste addicts. If your city builds $100 million plant to burn garbage, they operate most effectively if they run all the time. You are locking yourself into continued waste production for decades and continued contamination. So my biggest message for journalists is be vigilant because this is coming. And if we can resist it, we can actually drive real solutions this time.
Okay. Well, good set of diverse perspectives and back and forth. Thank you to the panelists, and thank you all for coming.